This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Last month, professional football quarterback Colin Kaepernick gained attention after he refused to stand for the national anthem, and he explained it this way.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust, people aren't being held accountable for, and that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all, and it's not happening for all right now.
Kaepernick has continued his protest, and dozens of professional athletes have joined in. But his actions remain divisive. Some people say he's being disrespectful to the military. Supporters say it is starting conversations about police brutality and racial inequality. As Kaepernick's protest grows, racial tensions have escalated in Charlotte and elsewhere. In Charlotte, following the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott last week, Kaepernick's protest and police violence are a few of the things we'll talk about in this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me, as always, are Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University and the author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
Good to have you.
Good. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark, are you surprised? It's been more than a month since Colin Kaepernick began that protest. Are you surprised that it has gained this much traction and is still in the news?
I think two things occurred that gives it resonance in this moment. The recent death of Muhammad Ali and athletes and other folks having to think about his moment of protest. And the fact that this was an Olympic year and we can look back and remember Mexico City in 1968. I imagine even for Colin Kaepernick, these were things that were in his mind as he was thinking about a way to express his own passions around this political moment. So I'm not surprised at that resonance, right? You have a younger generation of folks who've been introduced to this form of protest. And so they're kind of closing ranks around Colin Kaepernick. And of course, we've seen it up and down the line from high school athletes, you know, to collegiate athletes, to other NFL players and other sports, you know, also embracing this particular moment to protest.
I had members of the military and members of police departments also, some members supporting what they did. But the criticism, Natalie, would be in the way he did it. Last month on this program, we were talking about NBA athletes who took the moment of the ESPY Awards to stand up and make a statement. That wasn't the kind of gesture that not standing for the national anthem is, and many people say that went too far. I mean, what do you make of that critique?
That Colin Kaepernick's?
Colin Kaepernick's critique, his form of protest is the thing that rankles
people. It went too far.
Yeah.
I just think it's, I think it has to do with the visibility of what he did. And it's football, so that's like, you know, that's like...
fervor, right?
It's almost like he gave the finger to God, basically.
Yeah. God, nation, and football.
Exactly. Right. So the sanctity, I guess I will say in quotes, of football and what it means in our culture, I think, you know, makes it feel like it is inappropriate to take that sort of stand in such a visible way within that forum. And, you know, I tend to disagree, but I think that's where people are coming from.
Well, here's what Colin Kaepernick says about using that platform deliberately.
This stand wasn't for me. This stand wasn't because I feel like I'm being put down in any kind of way. This is because I'm seeing things happen to people that don't have a voice, people that don't have a platform to talk and have their voices heard and affect change. So I'm in a position where I can do that, and I'm going to do that for people that can't.
49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick speaking last month about the protest. He was at KTVU-TV in San Francisco. I will have to say, as an observer of the political scene and as somebody who's paid attention to football over the years, I thought to myself, this is the end of his career and possibly, you know, in a way that's unhealthy. I mean, I did not expect anyone to come to his support. Are you surprised at the number of athletes who've actually rallied to this, top to bottom, not only in football, other sports and other divisions, too, all the way down to high school?
I think this is a generational moment, right? You know, this didn't occur as a one-off attempt. Like, when we think about Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the former Chris Jackson, and his protests as an NBA player 20 years ago, you know, that's not framed around what is a movement moment, right? We are in a movement moment, right? We're of a generation that is tethered to this idea of movement. And so I'm not surprised that he's gotten that type of support. You know, what I find ironic about this is that it says, I think, a great deal about how America thinks of itself right now, that if America's psyche is so fragile that it can't withstand the backup quarterback for one of the worst football teams in the league taking a knee, or if we're talking about the city of Fayetteville, if it can't withstand a teacher, you know, demonstrating a law that actually protects your right to be able to protest against the flag, if the nation can't withstand those types of symbolic moments, it says a great deal about where the American psyche is at this point.
Well, yeah, and how fragile the system is itself, and the kind of reverence that we've come to expect. You know, again, I'm an old guy who's been going to sporting events at stadiums for a long time. They used to start the national anthem, and everybody stood. Then at some point along the way, there was an announcer who said, please stand for the play. That was not. Now, please stand and remove your hat. In other words, you really have to be instructed, because you know what? People don't want to. There's a lot of people there who actually would just as soon sit it out. And if they weren't told what to do, they just might not.
Yeah. And, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, or I think is really interesting about Kaepernick's movement, as we're calling it, is that it's actually gone beyond high school students. I mean, there was a little little league football team that kneeled during the national anthem and received death threats. So I totally agree with Mark about the fact that this is a youthful moment, that the youth, millennials, and you know, that the little kids have not quite been determined where they fall, but they are tethered to this moment, to this movement moment. But I think that we are, as a nation, too quick to kind of deal in hypocrisy, because on the one hand, it's blasphemous, was the word I was reaching for earlier, for Kaepernick to take a knee for the national anthem. But then, you know, in the same breath, people turn around and boo the president of the United States.
Call him a liar.
Yeah, when he does his opening, you know, statement for the season. So I just think that, we're really fragile and we need to kind of take some steps back.
You know, part of this, I think we're dealing with a post 9/11 reality, right? This kind of conflation around patriotism and support of the military and how you respect the flag is really connected. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Rick Monday, you know, playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers or the Chicago Cubs at the time, you know, was running out in the outfield as someone's burning an American flag, and he runs out there to save the flag. Mm-hmm. And it became this kind of, you know, moment, you know, of patriotism. But, you know, it was framed very differently than it is in this 9/11 year. You know, Major League Baseball after 9/11, not only was it the national anthem, but they would perform America the Beautiful. And they compelled all the major league players to have to stand for it. Carlos Delgado, who was playing for the Toronto Blue Jays at the time and was from Puerto Rico, as a protest of U.S. policy towards Vieques, would never stand up during that period of time. And I'm thinking about how he would have been dealt with in the social media era, you know, around that kind of protest. And again, Kaepernick is connecting to a larger tradition. We've seen athletes do this historically. Mm-hmm. It's different at this moment because it is a movement moment. And of course, obviously, of social media platforms.
Well, one of the critiques is that it was indeed blasphemous, that it was way too over the top. The other critique, and this one leveled by, among others, Jason Whitlock, who's a sports commentator, is that it was, in fact, disingenuous. It was not about protest. Mm-hmm. It was all about him. Let's listen.
He's created something that's easy to do, and it's easy to look like you're for something significant. It's a fad, man. That's all I can say. I said it last week, and I'm gonna say it again. The whole police brutality thing, it's a hot take. And everybody loves a hot take because it's good for clicks, it's good for retweets, it's good for likes, it's good for your popularity and relevancy. He's created a movement around, a fad around Colin Kaepernick. It's no different. You remember the dab last year?
Right.
That's all this is. This is the new version of the dab.
Jason Whitlock on Fox Sports earlier this month, Mark.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have no words for Jason Whitlock.
Well, but the critique. Let's look at this. I mean, is it easy to say, oh, I'm going to take a cause? Yeah, I'm a quarterback, a little bit on the cusp. Maybe I'll do a little something for my
career. I think if you're Jason Whitlock, it is hot for you to be able to respond that way, mm-hmm. right? It gets you clicks. It gets folks viewing you and reading your articles.
So he's the hot take.
Right. I mean, because, again, we're talking about something that's not just the first time. There's a tradition of this amongst Black American athletes in terms of protesting. And it's not as if this is in a vacuum. You know, to be so suspicious or cynical of Colin Kaepernick to think that somehow he doesn't want to get cut, you know, and this was his way that if he was out there politically, then the San Francisco 49ers wouldn't cut him. It's just so cynical. And it's the kind of cynicism that we often attach to Black athletes because we don't believe that they actually have a level of commitment to anything other than materialism and making money.
But also, you know, Jason Whitlock talks about how police brutality, this whole idea of police brutality and the implication is against Black people is a hot take, mm-hmm. that's a fad. And it reminds me of something I read that the Fox commentator Steve Doocy said, that white privilege and implicit bias is a farce. I mean, you know, if this is exactly why Black Lives Matter is a movement, because there is this belief that any sort of protest against what is obvious in terms of the discrimination and racial bias against Black people in this country, specifically when it comes to the police, is real. And for Jason Whitlock, who is a Black man,
yes,
to say something like that, it just underscores the reason why we, Colin Kaepernick, needs to take a knee. We all need to take a knee, and we need to keep having these conversations.
We will keep having the conversation on the state of things with my guest, popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, back channel today on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, with me for the latest installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context, talking about Colin Kaepernick, sports and politics, racial violence in America. Let's move to Charlotte. Mark, you wrote recently an essay called "The Mundaneness of Blackness" regarding police and recent police shootings. Tell us more about that message.
You know, I was inspired by the piece that Norman Mailer wrote so many years ago called The White Negro. And it's an essay in which he's trying to think through the emergence of a generation of white hipsters and what they were taking from or consuming from Blackness. So he makes the argument, and I think a valid one, that for the average African-American, you know, every turn of the corner, there's danger and violence that's potentially there. And it speaks to the everydayness of the threats of violence. You can simply be breaking down on the road, you know, which is the case in Tulsa. You could be sitting in your car, you know, waiting for your child to get off a school bus and might be rolling a joint. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be Eric Garner, you know, simply, you know, trying to breathe. I mean, there's so many of these incidences that are not about spectacular Blackness. It's not about spectacular radical acts to get Black people killed. It's the day-to-day mundane things that we do. And for me, that's it, exactly what makes these killings so absurd, that it's not folks doing anything extraordinary or dangerous. They're just living their everyday lives, and living your everyday life can get you killed if you're Black in America.
Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to the tendency to lump Black people together in one big group and criminalize all of us. So it doesn't matter what you're doing, really, at the end of the day. It's the fact that you're Black and you are unfortunately in the wrong place at the wrong time, and police generally are looking at you as they look at, you know, criminals, whether you are one or not. So you can be doing something mundane and it doesn't matter.
Well, and so this is the question of implicit bias. And this is the thing that the body cams can't capture, that we can't really get out in testimony in a court of law or in material evidence. But it does show up periodically. We get this question of the proof of implicit bias, which is what's at the root of all of this. And at this time, it came in the voice of U.S. Representative from North Carolina, Robert Pittenger, who was asked by a BBC newscaster kind of why he thinks all this is going on. And here's Robert Pittenger's first response, the first thing out of his mouth.
Well, no, the grievance in their mind is the animus, the anger. They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. I mean, yes, it is. It is a welfare state. We have spent trillions of dollars on welfare, but we put people in bondage so that they can't be all that they're capable of being.
Mark, why do you hate white people? I mean, what is it about me that you don't like?
I hate stupid people. That's what I hate. You know, the rhetoric is so 1950s. I mean, that's the thing that was so striking. Like the Trump, you know, campaign work in Ohio, you know, who intimated the same thing that Pittenger did here in North Carolina. You know, you're wondering where these folks live. And I think it speaks a great deal when we have these conversations about police brutality and the mundaneness of it. You know, white folks are not there in the everyday lives of black folks.
That's so
right. They don't know what those everyday reactions are like. When I listen to someone like Gene Demby, you know, at NPR's Code Switch, and he talks about, you know, if you want to talk about the differences between black and white folks and use automobiles as an example, white folks get stopped for speeding. Black folks get stopped for driving.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
No, the number of stops. You know, it's kind of interesting. We just there's a report out today of a British study at Cambridge University that shows a 93% decrease in the number of complaints made against officers when they're using body cameras. 93% decrease in complaints when there is going to be visible proof that maybe what you did was unwarranted. Oh, I mean, so again, this is a suggestion that without this kind of evidence, that there is something going on that somebody doesn't want you to see.
And the implicit bias piece is also, there's a study just came out from Yale about the fact that they're looking at preschool teachers engaged in implicit bias at 3 and 4 years old when they're expecting certain kinds of behavior, particularly from black boys. And so they over surveil, you know, black males and find things that occur because they're watching them all the time. You know, this is at 3 and 4 years old. What we see with law enforcement is the same practice
right. When
black men and when black women become adults.
Yeah. And one of the things that I remember learning about race very early on is that black people know everything about white people. Like, we know how to navigate the white world, but white people know nothing about us. And as a result, again, this mundaneity of black life is lost on most white people because they've never experienced or interacted with black people on a regular basis. So they don't know the nuances of our lives. We know them, and we that's why we get tired of trying to explain it, because right. You have to experience
it. But this raises the question to me, because every time, you know, with every new episode, with every new protest, we say, well, at least we're raising the conversation, at least we're starting to have the conversation. Are we? What conversation? Who's conversing? In social media, there are silos of people who think they know the answers. Are we talking to each other, and are we getting to know more about each other or less? Mark,
you know, it's a classic neoliberal response. You know, there are issues and there are critiques, and the way that we deal with the critiques is to contain the critiques within these institutions so that there's never an opportunity for a radical voice to emerge that's actually going to put pressure on the institutions if the institutions are incorporating those radical voices into its own spaces. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a look. You talked about Decoded. I want to talk about the way media now, so conventional media and maybe social media, are changing the conversation. Let's take a look. We talk about Black Lives Matter. It's a political movement outside of the party structure. And so that's a kind of to some extent, an extra political movement, although obviously it's deeply political. And let's talk about the way it's being portrayed on the media, too. I want to talk about a series called Decoded on MTV. It's hosted by Francesca Ramsey. First of all, Natalie, what are your impressions of this program and the way, obviously, this is a program meant to appeal to millennials, right, younger audiences?
Well, I think that the brilliance of it is that it breaks down, I mean, it very well, it's very well done. It breaks down kind of lofty, heady concepts into something that's digestible, so that millennials who may not have exposure to the history or to the context, they're given that in pretty quick sound bites. I think it's very effective. It helps. I mean, I've learned a lot from Francesca Ramsey.
Well, let's hear what you might learn. Here's a clip from an episode of Decoded that looks at myths surrounding Black Lives Matter.
Scrolling through your Facebook feed, you'll probably see articles and arguments about Black Lives Matter. A lot of people are mad or just confused about this movement. So here are responses to four questions you might hear when talking about Black Lives Matter.
Oh, so you care about Black lives? Then why aren't you talking about Black on Black crime?
First off, this assumes that the Black community isn't worried about gun violence, which isn't true. For example, Ceasefire in Chicago is an organization that actually intervenes in local street and gang fights. There's even a documentary about them called The Interrupters. Black Lives Matter isn't just about the loss of life, which is always terrible, it's about the lack of consequences when Black lives are taken at the hands of the police. When a civilian has committed a violent crime, they're generally arrested, tried, and then convicted. Conversely, there's a lot of evidence that it's very rare to secure an indictment against a police officer for excessive force, and an indictment is just a trial, it's not even a conviction. Also, Black on Black crime isn't a thing. 84% of white murder victims were killed by another white person. But we don't call it white on white crime. That's because our communities are still very segregated. So if you have the misfortune of being the victim of a crime, the perpetrator will most likely look like you. So why do people always bring up Black on Black crime? Because it's a diversion. They're trying to prove Black citizens don't have the right to be outraged about police violence because their communities have a crime problem. But the truth is, Black people are not more violent or more likely to commit crimes than anyone else. The reality is, because of a history of institutional racism, Black communities have higher poverty rates, suffer from poorly funded schools, and are more likely to be targeted by police.
All right, that's a clip from the program Decoded, hosted by Francesca Ramsey on MTV News in July, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. So what do you make of that? I mean, that's framed as a kind of a news program on MTV.
I mean, I think it's brilliant because millennials are not, I don't think, paying attention to MSNBC. I mean, like, as good as Joy Ann Reid and Chris Hayes and anybody else is on cable news, they're just not. They're not pulling in 20-year-olds to pay attention to that. So what Francesca Ramsey is doing, I think, is really doing some heavy lifting in terms of giving these kids background and context for what's going on currently so that they can understand and participate in the conversation. And I think that's incredibly useful.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, when we think about young folks, they're not listening to NPR, they're not listening to the radio. They're much more drawn to podcasts, they're much more drawn to things on Periscope and social media. And so to find a way to be able to translate the work that they do, you know, I find it interesting, like you take a platform like Al Jazeera, which shuts down its U.S. operation, but they keep producing AJ Plus, you know, which is their, you know, online digital YouTube channel, which specifically crafts little 2 and 3 minute, you know, news stories that's particularly pitched to the millennials. And it's been very successful because it uses that platform.
But it does run the risk of all becoming, again, kind of a siloed. I'm going to play a clip now from the political opposite of Francesca Ramsey. This is Tommy Lahren. And Tommy Lahren, the show is called Tommy. It's on the Blaze. She's talking about Colin Kaepernick here.
Colin, I support the First Amendment. I support your right to freedom of speech and expression. Go for it, bud. It's this country, the country that you have so much disdain for, that allows you the right to speak your mind. It protects your right to be a whiny, indulgent, attention-seeking crybaby. It also protects my right to shred you for it. See, the national anthem and our flag, they are not symbols of Black America, White America, Brown America, or Purple America, for that matter. There are patriots of every race that have fought and died for this country, and we honor the flag and sing the anthem as a reminder. And Colin, if this country disgusts you so much, leave. I guarantee there are thousands and thousands of people around the world that would gladly take your spot. Because those that don't live under this flag are banging on the door to get in, not get out. Remember that.
All right, there's a clip from Tommy, hosted by Tommy Lahren on The Blaze last month. We're talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. But again, there's the polarization. Everybody's got a platform. I mean, so the question is, you know, is any of this? I mean, go back to Francesca Ramsey. Are we adding to the debate when these two individuals sort of take a platform that is really targeted at different individuals or different groups? I mean, that's my question here, is less about the content and more about these platforms and who gets chosen to actually be the spokespeople.
I mean, in some ways, it's no different than what we've seen in the emergence of talk radio, particularly 20 years ago, right, where you could have, you know, the left was never successful sustaining talk radio that way. It's really the right to try to take advantage of it and has done so very successfully. But I don't think it's any different. I think you do have pockets of folks politically who just engage different kind of media, you know, whether we're talking about the old MSNBC versus, you know, Fox and what have you. The silo problem is critical, because how do we create those spaces where there is actually a rich exchange of ideas that matter in ways that are going to impact folks? I'd like to say that happens in the classroom. It probably doesn't happen as often as it needs to. You know, you almost want to figure out, how do we recreate the whole idea of the public sphere, the way Habermas talked about it, you know, a place where the town comes together and actually has a conversation. The difference is that, you know, folks aren't listening to it, right? It's all about now the blurb, right? It's about the 20-second soundbite. You know, I say this all the time. You know, I miss my William F. Buckley-type conservatives, right? Yeah. Folks who were about ideas and read, and if they were looking at counter arguments, they actually read those counter arguments and took them serious.
Mm-hmm. I think that I think Facebook is probably another siloed,
sure,
you know, area.
Well, social media in general, right?
Social media in general. I mean, the whole idea of the bubble, and the fact that, you know, you can have these conversations with people who basically agree with you, and you'll never encounter someone who has a counter argument. I mean, I think your question is you know, it's really legitimate. I don't know that we are having these cross conversations. I don't know if Tommy Lahren and Francesca Ramsey would ever meet up, you know, figuratively or literally, to have this type of conversation and hash out the differences in opinion and perspective. But I think it is, I mean, definitely it's necessary, but I don't think we have enough spaces.
But,
for
you
that.
Know, in our current media environment, I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't connected to the same conglomerate.
Probably.
And kind of pushed out specifically to create these kind of siloed tensions.
Yeah, but it's not even conversations, it's experiences. If you, I mean, I've done a rough poll of my friends, and of the 90 friends and family who are white, 0% have ever been pulled over for no reason. Mm-hmm. And of the African-American friends that I've spoken to, and now I'm up to 27, 100% have been pulled over. If
context,
I don't have that experience, if I'm not in the car bent over when they're pulled over and see it for myself, I'm just not going to believe that that's happening to you. I'm just going to be hard for me to believe that you've been pulled over 7 times or 8 times in your life and the officer let you go without a single explanation for why you were pulled over.
I mean, one of the things that came out, of course, in Charlotte, you know, Charlotte is hyper-segregated. And I think that the really interesting fiction of American society in the 21st century now is, despite Brown versus Board of Education and all the struggle that we saw in the 50s and the 60s, America might be as much, if not more, segregated as it was 60 years ago.
Right.
Well, let's talk about more general media now, not the siloed stuff, but there is still television out there. It's not broadcast TV with only 3 networks, but there is television. I want to talk about some new programs, relatively new programs that portray black life. Tell us about the show Queen Sugar on the Oprah Winfrey Network, Mark.
It is based on a novel that was, you know, fairly popular, and it's significant because Ava DuVernay, who of course we know as a Hollywood filmmaker, who of course did the Oscar-nominated Selma, has chosen to work on the small screen, right? And we've seen so many auteurs, you know, decide to work on the small screen now. Because it gives them a little bit more impact to reach a wider audience. It allows them to be a little bit more expressive than they are in film. It allows them to tell a story in a serialized form. So Queen Sugar is about a family that's based in Louisiana. The patriarch of the family is a landowner, you know, 800 acres growing sugarcane. And it's a conversation that we don't see anymore, because we always think about blackness in a rural context, right? In an urban context. Mm-hmm. This is blackness in a rural context. This is about black farmers, you know, a segment of the population that we don't nearly talk enough, even as they're under assault, you know, even under the Obama administration.
Well, and a tough subject in African-American communities, because it represents, in a way, a going back to, you know, and if you think about the American, I mean, there was a good piece about this in The Guardian that points to the sort of progressive idea of cities and future and the regressive idea of going back to the far. Let's play a little clip from Queen Sugar to show some of the issues that this program takes on.
He's something else, Charlie. You know that?
Whoa, it is just some drinks, tables, and linens. I thought it would help.
Don't nobody need no fancy-ass linen.
Okay, look, I'm paying for it, so what's it matter? Just let the service handle it. They know what they're doing.
And you don't know a damn thing about nothing except wasting money. How long you been gone? Huh? You ain't been gone that long. How come you don't remember how it's done?
Oh, and how it's done has to be your way.
Ain't that right? I've been trying to help, but for some reason, you've been blocking me at every turn.
We don't honor our father by sitting friends and family outside at fancy tables. We don't honor our father by having strangers serve those grieving. We serve comfort food to those who need comfort, and we do it with our own hands. That's how a family doesn't repass. And we certainly don't pay our respects with American Express. Now get those folks out that yard!
All right, there's a clip from the television program Queen Sugar on the Oprah Winfrey Network. We talked about having conversations in this country. When we say that, when we talk about race, we think about black and white. But in some ways, we're talking about these are conversations within African-American communities that are being sort of shown on television.
And so back to the point that Mark made about the mundaneness of blackness. That's what is really beautiful about Queen Sugar, is that it is showing the mundaneity of black life in beautiful, vibrant color. We are having seeing these conversations and seeing the tensions that come up within families, you know, played out in a way that I think we all can relate to. And I have to admit, initially, it was a little slow for me. But, you know, Ava DuVernay says something really interesting in her promo trailer for Queen Sugar, and that is that she allows for silence just so that the scenes can play out and you can see facial expressions. And, you know, we don't live our lives in sound bites. We're not always talking. So I think that's part of the beauty of what Queen Sugar is doing.
Our conversation on Back Channel continues with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. More television and a recap of the Emmys just ahead. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, with me for another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. Today we're talking about media, television, sports, and racial conversations across America. Right now we're talking about new television programs, relatively new shows. Mark, tell us about another one on OWN. It is called Greenleaf, and it just finished its first season.
You know, it's funny because when we think about the black church drama, you know, the person who has really presented that into the mainstream public over the last 15 years is Tyler Perry. But he rarely has done that with any kind of depth and seriousness. What we see in Greenleaf is a story that takes serious, right, the impact and import of the black megachurch, the politics that's associated with it, how it impacts family. And again, like, you know, Ava DuVernay's piece in Queen Sugar, it's about slow black culture. Right. It's about the black culture and consuming black culture that you have to live with. Right. That you can't right. just toss it aside and consume it and move on to something else. These are things that you actually have to live with. And I think it's a particular victory for Oprah Winfrey and OWN, because, again, you know, she built that brand largely on relationships with Tyler Perry and Tyler Perry's shows. It has allowed her to sustain and kind of find a foundational piece, you know, economically and otherwise. And now she can go on to doing the kind of work that I imagine she wanted to do with the network very early, but didn't have the kind of support for it just yet.
And what about, I mean, we talked about the slowness. This is a couple times now that that's come up, and how that works against the type that we've seen most often in media, which is a much more frenetic kind of character. There's just a lot of action that goes around characters, often in when African-Americans are portrayed in media. This is a very different way of for the public to view life in various cultures and various communities.
Definitely. I'm interested and will be interested to see how sustainable what OWN is doing with Queen Sugar and Greenleaf will be. Because OWN doesn't have quite yet the ratings of a Shondaland. Like, you know, Shonda completely dominates Thursday nights on ABC. But I think that there is the potential, and at least Oprah is cultivating that audience and helping us to appreciate the silence and the breath that is given to these characters and these storylines because they're not so frenetic. They're it's not Scandal. It's not How to Get Away with Murder. Right. It's a totally different approach.
And yet it's complicated. So again, this becomes dangerous if you're talking about popular media where you're going to take a look at political issues and they can be clickbait unless you decide that we've got our own problems in these communities. We can have tax problems within the church. We can have abuse within the church, homophobia, these kind of questions we can deal with, as well as other issues like police brutality and things that we as a community are facing.
And I mean, that's the thing that's great about how Queen Sugar in particular is done. It's actually taking up these topical circumstances, right? So it allows us to actually think about police brutality in a really different kind of context, right? Even as it's taking place outside our door.
Right.
You know, one of the main characters has been indicted on rape. You know, it's a way for us to talk about what's happening with someone like Derrick Rose, right, in the larger, you know, environment around basketball players and rape cases. I mean, this is really good television that links some of the anxieties we have about what's happening in the real world, but fictionalizes in a way that we can actually think about it significantly, you know, as it's playing out in these kind of spaces.
Well, here's a clip from Greenleaf, and here is Bishop James Greenleaf delivering a sermon with police officers in the audience as he references the Black Lives Matter movement.
And finally, I'm here to remind our guests, the brave men and women who police our streets, and God bless them all sincerely for doing a job I know I'm not brave enough to do myself. Those people you're shooting out there aren't shadows. They're people. They're real. They're not characters in some video game. Black lives matter. Black lives matter. Black lives matter. Black tears matter. Black feelings. Black hopes. Black regrets. Black breakfast. Black lunch. Black dinner matters. Whatever we're doing with our lives.
As a clip from the program Greenleaf, the Oprah Winfrey Network, my guests are Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Boy, we're getting back to this kind of quotidian nature of, right? I mean, there's an element. You can hear Dr. Martin Luther King and sort of the lofty themes that would have been in his talk. And now we're talking about breakfast, lunch, and dinner in those same tones, in those same cadences.
Yeah, you know, what Bishop Greenleaf does in that moment reminds me of the character Ralph Angel from Queen Sugar. I mean, there's parallels there because he is a convicted felon who has been released from prison, is back home, is trying to move on with his life, and the tensions of, you know, both trying to move forward but still sort of struggling with the behaviors and the mindset that got him in prison in the first place is so nuanced in a way that, you know, we never see that, you know, in traditional television. You know, that I think there is so much work being done with these two shows that really helps us to connect with these inner conversations, these interior issues that we have in Black lives that are not revealed, they're not expressed, they're not exposed to the mainstream.
And it reveals the sort of the downside too, the underside. I mean, here is a clip again from Greenleaf, where the church is wrestling with some financial troubles.
The Senate is launching an inquiry, James, into whether your church and others like it are taking advantage of your tax-exempt status to bilk the American people out of billions of dollars.
For real?
For real. What?
Well, I'm just wondering, what are white people gonna think when they see Black people picking on each other like this?
What will Black people think if we don't?
There's a clip from Greenleaf on the Oprah Winfrey Network. We're talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I guess the question, too, is who's the target audience for these programs, Mark? I mean, and do you expect any kind of crossover?
I think if they get some traction, I think what OWN is able to do now is to resonate within a particular niche audience that is Black, a little bit more literate than, say, the mainstream audience that might have read the novel or is interested in reading the novel, if we're talking about Queen Sugar, that it's also interested in complicating the story of blackness. You know, Natalie just mentioned Ralph Angel, and one of the things I love about Queen Sugar is that it is a platform for what I'll describe as black grown manness, you know, in ways that we've never really seen sustained on television.
What do you mean?
You know, Ralph Angel, for instance, is a single father, right? So he's dealing with holding on to the responsibilities of trying to be a good single father, right? With his dead father is kind of being the anchor for him there. You know, his young son plays with a Barbie doll. And watching him navigate with his son, because he's clearly uncomfortable with his son playing with his doll, but understands that the doll is important to his son. And so, like, he'll allow his son to play with it privately. But when they're out in public, right, then it raises questions. And he's always trying to navigate those spaces. But he's thoughtful enough to understand that this is something that's important to my son, and I can't take a very rigid, hard line. One of my favorite characters, Omar Dorsey, plays a character called Hollywood. 40-ish old black man. He's worked with, Omar Dorsey has worked with Ava DuVernay in the past. I've never seen that kind of grown black man. He has a conversation with his partner, who's played by Tina Lifford, and she's acknowledging to him that she cannot have children. If he wants to have children, he might want to find somebody young. She's a little older than she is. And he simply goes, I am here with you. Right. And he's working with her. He's affirming her as an older black woman who's also kind of struggling with where she is in the world, because this is the other thing that I think all of these series do. They affirm the idea of black women maturing and remaining beautiful and attractive and alluring in ways that we rarely see. Mm-hmm. Right. We don't have to see Beyonce and Rihanna characters walking around, and there's nothing wrong with those women. But to be able to see grown black women portrayed with the delicacies that they're dealing with the fragilities that dealing with, we don't see enough of that on television either.
And so for that reason, I think that the target audience is black people. I don't think that these that Queen Sugar or Greenleaf are made for a mainstream audience, because they're not gonna understand, they're not gonna watch. But I think it is important, just as Ava DuVernay says in her promo trailer for Queen Sugar, that we see ourselves. We see ourselves in reality, not as caricatures, not as, you know, what we, you know, what we, like the fantastic version of us, but as we are. And that is what both Queen Sugar and Greenleaf, to a lesser extent for me, because I haven't really kept up with it, but Queen Sugar absolutely plays back for black people ourselves. There's little pieces of ourselves in all the characters, and that's what's amazing about it.
The other thing that becomes important for what Owen is doing, it actually gives also platforms for very, very talented black actors and actresses who normally don't get opportunities.
Right.
You take Reverend Greenleaf as an example, who's played by Keith David. Keith David has put in so much work over the course of his career and has never really gotten his due for his skill. And finally, he actually has a role that allows him to exhibit, you know, who he is. Glenn Turman, who plays the patriarch for just one episode of Queen Sugar, who one generation might know from Cooley High back in the day, who another generation might know from A Different World,
right?
And even some generation would know as the mayor of Baltimore in The Wire. But, you know, he did more acting in his deathbed scene, you know, which I'm hoping that there's a real campaign to get him a nomination next year for Emmy, because what he does in that scene, you know, he's waited a whole career
to have that
opportunity on mainstream television.
Actors and directors. So, you talked about the Emmys. Let's switch topics and talk a little bit about them. One of the top winners, the FX miniseries, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, America Crime Story, An American Crime Story. 5 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Mark and Natalie, what do you think drew people to that show? Natalie, let me start with you.
I mean, I think it's just the spectacle of O.J. I don't think that it's, you know, that there was an expectation of, you know, amazing characters or amazing television. I think the story of O.J. is because race is at the center of it, I think, is a part of it. That is what drew people to that miniseries. And then people were surprised, pleasantly so, to see that the acting was amazing and the production of it was amazing. And so you know, it just came, it all came together.
I think Natalie is absolutely right. One of the other things I want to consider in thinking about that series is that, you know, when there's Black Lives Matter moment, and part of that moment is premised on the idea of Black innocence. You know, that these are folks who are getting killed who are not criminal, they're innocent. And OJ becomes a counter to the claim of Black innocence. Yep. Bill Cosby becomes a counter to the claim of Black. Even Nate Parker becomes a counter to the claim of Black innocence. And, you know, thank God we're complex enough to be able to hold OJ, Bill Cosby, Nate Parker accountable for their behavior. But let's understand the reason why these narratives attract the kind of attention they do. Right. You know, because OJ was that crossover Black figure, because Bill Cosby was the father of Black morality, if you will, right, for them to fall down, right, is that perfect counter to whatever claims Black Lives Matter might be making towards Black innocence.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you bring that up, Mark, because now I'm thinking about Nate Parker and Rape Trial versus Nat Turner film, Birth of a Nation, right? So there's this, the indictment of whiteness that Nate Parker is doing, but then he's indicted, right?
Undermines it.
Right. So then Bill Cosby, as you said, the moral, respectable Black father, and then here we go with the sexual assault. And I mean, so in every instance, I'm pretty sure we could track it. When you have a Black man in particular, because that's pretty much what we are dealing with, who is has fallen out of grace, let's say, just like OJ. OJ, I mean, here's the heinous murders, but he's football's darling. I mean, you know, so it's really interesting how that works and how these, you know, there's a need almost in our culture to find somebody that we can say, well, look, they, you know, they did what they did.
And what I don't hear you saying is that they should not be held accountable, to go back to what you said.
No,
when you
should.
Do the wrong thing, you want to get caught and you want to be held accountable for doing the wrong thing. There's no letting you off the hook for that.
Right.
It's that you are now going to stand for every claim about Black police brutality that has ever been made that
right.
becomes the problem. That
right.
when we found two guilty Black men who are in a high profile, it means none of you were telling the truth.
And right. I think a part of, like, to take that a step further, we just found out that Keith Scott, the man that was killed in Charlotte, you know, had threatened his wife.
There was a restraining order
against him that was released into the public. Why? I mean, what does that have to do, right? We're always trying to justify why police have killed somebody. Because even if they didn't know in the moment, that wasn't the motivation for them taking somebody out. We can look back far enough and we'll find a reason.
And the OJ case, I think, becomes even critical here because OJ was someone in which the LAPD was complicit in him getting away with abuse for
right.
so long.
Mm-hmm.
So he becomes the example. It's like, well, we don't hate Black people because look how we,
treated
you know, we
OJ.
Took care of OJ
right. Right.
for so many years.
That is the end of our program for now. We will be back again next month, and I want to thank you both, Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He is an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, also an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker. Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find links to everything we've talked about and more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.